I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bride silver.
We have to engage in the asceticism which makes it possible to savor nowness and here-ness. Here is a place. Here is that which is between us, as the kingdom is, in order to be able to save what remains in us of sense, of meaning, of metaphor, of flesh, of touch, of gaze.
Good horse amongst the rich ones, how oft times we go.
You're listening to episode 644 of Unwelcome Guests, Living Here and Now. I'm Robin Upton, and you've just heard Ivan Illich, whom we'll get back to in our second hour. This week we ask the question, have you got a personal philosophy? And if not, why not? Inspiration was from the following interview by C.S. Soong of Against the Grain from about 10 days ago with philosophy professor William Irvin, author of A Guide to the Good Life, The Ancient Art of Stoic Joy, and thanks to David Pierce for pointing me to this recording.
Happiness, contentment, equanimity, peace of mind, does any of this, or I should say, does achieving any of this interest you? Much of academic philosophy has long since turned away from addressing questions like how should we live and how can we be happy? But today's program is not about modern philosophy. It's about thinkers in ancient Greece and Rome who cared about peace of mind and contentment so much that they devised practical strategies for getting there, for dealing with loss, for reining in our desires, for handling insults, and much more. The thinkers were the Stoics. And if you think you know what a Stoic is, today's program and today's guest will make you think again. Founded by a man named Zeno, the Stoic school of philosophy flourished first in Greece and then in Rome. And they attracted followers and students precisely because they proposed ways of living a happier, fuller, more rewarding life. What are those ways, you ask? Can those methods apply to today, times of mass anxiety and profound uncertainty? William Irvin is a philosophy professor at Wright State University. He's also author of A Guide to the Good Life, The Ancient Art of Stoic Joy. I recorded an interview with Bill Irvin when the book came out. I began by asking Bill Irvin whether most people consciously develop a philosophy of life.
I think it's something people don't think about. They fall into what for most people is the default philosophy of life, which is a form of enlightened hedonism. And they want to have be comfortable, they want to experience pleasure, they want to avoid pain, and most people never get beyond that.
Tell me more about enlightened hedonism and why so many people adopt that philosophy.
Well, let's talk a little bit, first of all, about hedonism. And, of course, hedonism, a hedonist is a person who simply wants to be comfortable and enjoy, experience as much pleasure as he can in life. I suspect that we were evolutionarily programmed to seek pleasure and avoid pain. So it's kind of programmed into it, and that's why I say it's our default philosophy of life.
And why is it important to have a philosophy of life other than a kind of enlightened hedonism?
Well, the danger is that you will mislive, that you'll spend your life doing things that seem sensible and realize very late in the game that, in fact, you had this wonderful one-time opportunity at life and you spent it either pursuing the wrong things or maybe pursuing the right things, but pursuing them in a foolish manner. And you'll end up with a lot of regrets.
So how did you first become interested in Stoicism?
I became interested in it in a roundabout way. My book before this book was titled On Desire, Why We Want What We Want, and it was a wide-ranging explanation of human desire. And I went into that with a kind of an ulterior motive. I knew that in the process of doing research for that book, that I would be able to explore Zen Buddhism in considerable detail And I sort of thought that I would come out of the research project a full-fledged Zen Buddhist. And then a funny thing happened. The more I learned about Zen Buddhism, the more I realized that the fit just wasn't right between Zen Buddhism and myself. I'm a relentlessly analytical person, and Zen Buddhism would require me to turn off a lot of that analysis. Now, I'm not saying Zen Buddhism is a bad philosophy of life. There are many interesting parallels, in fact, between it and Stoicism. It's just that for me, the fit didn't work. Given my personality and my circumstances, it didn't work. And then the other surprise in the research was Stoicism, which at one time would have been a non-starter for me as a philosophy of life. The fit was wonderful. I found myself in a low-key way kind of putting their advice to work in my everyday life. And before I knew it, I was this rare entity, a 21st century human being who was a practicing Stoic.
What parallels did you find between Zen Buddhism and Stoicism?
One thing is they both think tranquility should be one of your primary goals in life. And once I say that, I have to do a little bit of explaining, because some people think that by tranquility I mean, the kind you could get by ingesting a tranquilizer. But for both of them, tranquility meant the relative absence of negative emotions in your life. Negative emotions like anger, fear, grief, anxiety, and the presence of positive emotions, with the most positive of positive emotions being feelings of joy. Both the Zen Buddhists and the Stoics believe that you should not become attached to things. You shouldn't cling to the world around you. And the Stoics developed some wonderful techniques for avoiding doing that. Both thought that to the extent possible, you should live in the present moment. And the Stoics were emphatic about this. I mean, most people go through life. The present moment consists of anxiety about the future moments they're going to experience and regrets about the past moments. And they were very interested in overcoming those emotional states so that you could embrace the present moment. And in fact, more generally, so you could embrace the life you're living, whatever that life might be.
Well, one thing you're very interested in overcoming are popular conceptions, popular misconceptions of what Stoicism is and what a Stoic is. Could you remind us what most people, and you, in fact, before you got into this field, think about what a Stoic is and how a person who is a Stoic acts?
Yeah, Stoicism, the Stoics in general, are victims of a bum rap. And unless you're an unusual person, everything you know about Stoicism is wrong. I mean, that was certainly the case with me, and I had studied philosophy, you know, as an undergraduate. I was a major, and then I went to graduate school. But people commonly think that the Stoics, the uppercase S Stoics, were lowercase s stoical, and that is that they were grim and unfeeling individuals, that they were emotional icebergs who kind of stood there and quietly took whatever life threw at them. But as I say, it turns out that the Stoics aren't opposed to emotion, but they're very much in favor of minimizing the number of negative emotions that we experience. And when I started reading about the lives of the Stoics themselves, it turns out that they were an unusually cheerful bunch of people. And you can find any number of passages where they tell you that what they're aiming at is joy, a state of joy. So it's the opposite of what you would think. I mean, other things came up in the research. It turns out that the skeptics weren't skeptics. The cynics weren't cynical in the modern sense. So we have a pretty dramatic misconception of all of these ancient philosophies.
We're speaking with William Irvin. He is a professor of philosophy at Wright State University in Dayton, Ohio, and author most recently of A Guide to the Good Life, The Ancient Art of Stoic Joy, recently out from Oxford University Press. Let's turn to some of these psychological techniques advocated by the Stoics. One that they advocated had to do with something you call negative visualization. What's that?
In negative visualization, you actively think about the bad things that could happen to you. You actively think about how your life could be worse. You contemplate it. So I don't want you to get the idea that the Stoics sit around and just dwell on this and just are anxious about it. But you just imagine the things that could happen that are negative. We all know that friendships can come to an end. You know, sometimes friends quarrel, sometimes friends die. And so the Stoics said, you know, when you say goodbye to your friend, one of the things you should do is you should allow the thought just briefly to enter your mind that this might be the last time you see your friend. Why would anybody do that? It seems like such a negative thing to do. It's because if you do that, you'll appreciate that friend in a way you won't appreciate him if you think, as most people do, that he'll be there forever. Another thing the Stoics said you should contemplate is your own death. And again, that seems like a terribly negative thing to do, except they claim that by contemplating your own death and by thinking, by realizing fully that you won't be here forever, if you do that, you will enjoy life so much more intensely than if you imagine, as many people do, that they're going to be around forever.
You bring up in this chapter the example of two fathers, one of whom periodically reflects on his daughter's mortality. Take us through this scenario.
Yeah, this is a line from the Stoic philosopher Epictetus, who gives this advice. He said, as you're kissing your daughter goodnight at bedtime, you should pause and think to yourself that this might be the last kiss, that she might be gone by tomorrow, by the morning. And when I've had my students read that, they're all just appalled. That's a terrible thing to do with a kid. Now, you're doing it in your own mind. You're not telling the kid, you know, you might die tonight, but you're reflecting on that. The claim is, and I believe this is true because I've done it, the claim is that if you do that, you will value your daughter. If your daughter is around the next day, as she probably will be, you'll appreciate her continued existence. And compare that to the father who assumes that the kid's always going to be around. That father is unlikely to be attentive. You know, when the kid comes down for breakfast, that father might just continue reading the newspaper. That afternoon, instead of playing with the kid, the father might go golfing. Because you know what? You can always play with the kid tomorrow. The first father, though, the one that actively contemplates the loss of the daughter, is going to take advantage of opportunities to interact. It's going to be a much closer relationship.
We often take things for granted, and I think one of the powerful justifications or reasons for doing negative visualization is precisely because we start appreciating things we took for granted beforehand. And this also has to do something with desire, and you bring up a phrase called hedonic adaptation. I guess two psychologists came up with that term. What is that, and how is that related to contemplating the bad things that could happen to us?
Yes, psychological adaptation is the process by which whatever you get in life, you take for granted. So really an insidious process. So here's how it works. We go through life forming dreams for ourselves. I mean, we might think of the perfect job. We might think of the perfect boyfriend or girlfriend or marrying the perfect person or having kids. And we work really hard to fulfill those dreams. And with hard work, we might succeed in fulfilling those dreams. And then a very unfortunate thing happens. We lose interest in the dream. We start taking it for granted. We marry the person of our dreams, and then 6 months later we find ourselves thinking, gee, are there greener pastures out there?
And or we buy the car we've always wanted, and we feel differently about it after a time.
Yes, and that's the standard process with consumer goods, all of the neat gadgets and leather goods and everything else we find ourselves lusting after. We get them. And there's that initial rush, I won't deny that, but then a short time later, the joy is out of the relationship or the ownership, and suddenly we want more. One of the things, if you want to have a good life will be a life in which you feel satisfied. hedonic adaptation prevents you from gaining satisfaction. Because of this process, this psychological process, you work hard to get something, and then once you get it, you no longer value the thing you worked hard to get, and so you have to work hard to get something else. One of the principal insights of the Stoics is that they came across a technique to stop this psychological process, this hedonic adaptation, and the process that they invented was negative visualization. So you work hard to get something. Once you get it, how can you keep being interested in it? How can you avoid taking it for granted? They said, well, you should spend time actively thinking about what your life would be like if you lost that thing you possess. So that car you got, one thing that can happen is you drive it around, then you start looking at the other cars on the road, and you start thinking, I could use a newer, better car. Well, another way to do it is the car you've got. Think about how you'd feel if it were stolen, if it were taken, if you couldn't have afforded it in the first place. And you can even break this down into smaller details. One of the things you take for granted involves your car, and that is the thought that when you get in it and turn the key, the engine's going to start and you're going to go roaring off to wherever you want to go. It's useful to think when you get in and the key starts that it didn't need to start, and you could have been sitting there in that frustrated state of mind, thinking, why won't my car start? But that didn't happen. And the curious thing is, if you do enough of this, what would normally be just everyday moments in life get this kind of nice glow to them. You realize things are actually pretty good.
It's an exquisite insight, this notion of, or this, I don't know what you would say, this habit the Stoics would have us develop of desiring not what we don't have, but desiring what we already have.
Yes.
I mean, is that a big part of it?
Yes. I mean, two things. Number one, learn to want the things you already have, because you already have them. And then the second thing is, although you want the things you have, and they're very careful on this, don't cling to the things you have. So learn to want the things you already have, and at the same time, don't cling to the things you already have. And, you know, the process I just described actually accomplishes both things. So if I imagine my car being stolen or burning up in a fire in the night or whatever, I will appreciate it more that I've got it. And also by visualizing the negative things that can happen to my car, in a sense, I prepare myself for the loss of the car. In a sense, I will have seen it coming. Same is true of friendships. Friends die. If you contemplate the loss of those friends, you accomplish two things. If you do lose it, you will have seen it coming. That'll take some of the sting out of it. And as long as the friendship continues, you'll value it much more intensely than you would if you imagined, if you took it for granted and imagined that it would always be something you could enjoy.
William Irvine is his name, Irvine. He joins us by phone from Dayton, Ohio, where he teaches philosophy at Wright State University. He's author of On Desire, Why We Want What We Want, and he's author most recently of A Guide to the Good Life, The Ancient Art of Stoic Joy. Let's turn to a chapter which has as its subtitle, On Becoming Invincible. What must happen in the Stoic way of thinking to our desires in order for us to be invincible?
The things life throws at you, you have to do a kind of a triage, and you have to realize that the things life throws at you fall into one of three categories. There's things over which you have complete control, things over which you have no control at all, and things over which you have some but not complete control. It's very foolish to spend your life worrying about things over which you have no control at all. And yet, so many people spend their lives doing that. What are the things over which you have complete control? Stoics said you can control your values, your goals, your character. And you should put a considerable amount of effort into developing your values, in choosing the proper values, in developing your character. What are the things you have some control over but not complete control over? Well, I mean, think about recreational activities like playing tennis, There's no guarantee that you'll win a game. Yet, by trying hard, you can affect the outcome of a game. So the Stoics would say, put your energy into that. But there are other things it's just pointless to worry about because you have no control at all over how they turn out.
Yeah, and this is really one of the puzzles because in my personal life, I will get upset over things that, of course, I realize later on or even maybe at that moment that I have no control over. It could be traffic lights. It could be the behavior of somebody whose conduct depends not at all on my conduct.
Yeah, and I guess I've gone through a kind of a personal transition here. I find being stuck in traffic, it's not perfectly tolerable. I don't know if it ever will be, but more tolerable than it used to. It's just a different frame of mind of realizing, well, I'm stuck in traffic, and I can either let this ruin my day, and a lot of people do, or I can do my best to enjoy this little interlude and try not to let it ruin my day. I have no control over it. If I fret over it, become anxious over it, all I succeed in doing is taking a bad situation and make it worse.
Okay, so let's return to your tennis match example. So this is something that we have some control over, but not complete control because we are playing someone else and it's up to them and their abilities to some degree. There's luck probably involved, how we happen to feel that day, the level of our performance that day. What attitude would the Stoics want us to take toward the issue of winning or losing that match?
Stoics would say that if you go into the game and your goal is to win, you're setting yourself up for possible bad feelings later on. A much wiser strategy is to, and the phrase I use for it, is to internalize your goals. So what you do is you make your goal something you do have complete or at least considerable control over, and then you can't lose. So what goal would that be? Well, the goal of trying your best in the game, of training as hard as you can for the game, of trying your best in the game. Then it's entirely within your control whether you achieve that goal. I should also point out here, by the way, that that's one of the best ways to actually win a tennis game, is to train to the best of your ability and play to the best of your ability.
Yeah, and it's fascinating what you point out in this book, which is that focusing on an external goal like winning could actually, what, hurt one's chances of achieving that very goal?
Sure. If you're intent on winning this tennis game and things start going against you, then it's easy to get rattled, and getting rattled can affect your play. But if your goal is to play to the best of your ability, then, you know, if the score isn't going quite how you want it to do, what you want it to do, you can still be confident that, well, it isn't going how I hoped, but still I'm doing the best I can in the situation, and that was my goal coming in.
Let's take a couple of other examples. So, for example, a worker trying to please her boss and a novelist who wants to get published.
Yeah, you can't be sure that you'll please your boss. Bosses can be fickle about such things. But one thing you can do is do your best. That's all you can do. I have an extended discussion of a would-be novelist. It's a very precarious position to be in because you're going to have to experience a lot of negativity from the time when you first sit down and decide you're going to write a novel to the time you finally get it published. You're going to hear no a lot of times. You're going to find that friends and relatives aren't necessarily as encouraging as they might be. And it's going to be a very difficult process. I suspect that many novelists fail. I mean, they never publish simply because they can't stand the external failure of getting letters of rejection or, as often happens, getting no letter at all in response to something you submit. So it's a classic example of a case where internalizing your goals is a wonderful device to use to increase your chances of success. So instead of saying, my goal is to publish this novel, say my goal is to submit this novel a certain number of times in a certain period. My goal is to make this the finest work that I can make this. My goal is to rewrite this and then rewrite it again. Goals where you have complete control. And again, the point is, those internal goals, by having those, you're less likely to experience that overwhelming sense of failure, and you're actually likely to increase your chances of succeeding.
That's William Irvin. Here he is taking up the issue of insults.
Insult can be a physical insult, it can be a verbal insult, but some of the best insults are insults by implication, where somebody doesn't actually say something insulting, but yet you go away feeling insulted. But the Stoics had this interesting take on insults. They are what I call insult pacifists. They said the best thing you can do in response to an insult is nothing at all. If you must say something, try to engage in some self-deprecating humor. It's something you don't hear people do very often, but I've been experimenting with it, and it seems to be quite successful as a strategy for dealing with insults.
And what can we do with our attitude toward insults? How do we take the sting out of them?
We have to realize that insults hurt because we care what other people think of us. So for them, they said it's very important that you realize that you can't control what other people think of you. You know what, even if you do wonderful things for them, even if you buy them a new car, or, I don't know, give them a kidney, you can be really, really nice to them. And it could just increase the chance that they hate you, or it could trigger envy in them. So you can't control what other people think of you. So stop worrying about it. Worry instead about things you can control, like your character. Try to become an honest person. Try to become a magnanimous person. And it's a curious thing, but there's a good chance that if you do that, people will like you better than if you went out of your way to try to make them like you.
Mm. The Stoics would also have us consider the source of the insult, correct?
Right. Realize that somebody who insults you has probably different values than you do. That's why they're insulting you. You aren't living in accordance with their values. And then once you keep that in mind, you can discount many of the insults. You realize, well, this is because he values something different than I do. I value tranquility. He values, I don't know, cars, fancy watches. He values something else. And it's sort of a shame that he values those things, because he's probably not going to have the best life possible by valuing them. So instead of getting mad at him, if anything, perhaps I should pity him for the values he has that triggered the insult that he just directed at me. And in a curious way, you transform what could be anger into pity. And, you know, Stoics, again, were careful. I don't think you should openly express your pity of the person, because that would be itself a form of insult. But it's something in your own mind that you can keep there, and it takes a considerable amount of the sting out of an insult.
And in this context, what do you think Epictetus, the Stoic philosopher, meant when he wrote, "What upsets people is not things themselves, but their judgments about these things"?
Right. Consider this. Here's an example. Suppose you're out for a walk and there's a neighborhood dog that's very territorial, and as soon as you walk by, the dog starts barking at you. I mean, we all agree you'd be foolish if you let that ruin your day. If you said, "Oh, that dog doesn't like me. Oh, dear, what can I do to make that dog like me?" You just ignore it. But now if the neighbor who owns the dog came out and called you a name, you'd probably let that sting you deeply. And it's because your attitude toward the dog is different than your attitude toward the neighbor. You don't care what the dog thinks of you. You do care what the neighbor thinks of you. So what puts the sting in the insult is your own mental attitude. And you have control over your mental attitude. So what makes the insult sting is not the insult itself, but your interpretation of the insult.
Well, we've been talking a lot, Bill, about tranquility and kind of peace of mind, not letting things bother you, keeping desires limited to what you already have. This suggests to some degree that maybe we ought to avoid people, given that they annoy us, they get in our way, even family members can irritate us. think of, you know, a lot of people talk about the holidays and how difficult those are with family. What did the Stoics believe about the way we ought to relate to and the degree to which we ought to expose ourselves to other people?
We have a duty toward other people. This is we have Marcus Aurelius saying, love mankind, which is something a lot of people would agree we ought to do. And his view was that the gods created us to help each other. So the Stoics, particularly Marcus Aurelius, is very big on what I call being socially useful. One of your goals in life, if you're a functioning Stoic, is to try to make yourself useful to your fellow human beings. And the curious thing is, now again, they were interested in living a good life, but I think that that's one component to living a good life, is that you're not just looking out for your own interests, but you're also trying to look out for interests of those around you.
And Bill, finally, you have adopted a Stoic way of life. You're not just describing these techniques in this book, A Guide to the Good Life, but you have practiced them. You have taken it upon yourself to see how they would work in your own life. What has happened to your desire and your sense of well-being since practicing these techniques?
Two notable things. First is, it's ruined me as a consumer. I go to the mall now. I go to the mall and I don't want the stuff. I look around and I just think, look at all the stuff I don't want. So that's one interesting thing. I don't regret that either. It's not like I'm consciously trying to stop myself from buying stuff. It's just that stuff that at one time seemed so important to me to possess no longer does. The other curious thing is, there's an element of joy in my life that previously wasn't there. And it's a curious thing, but these are just little outbursts of joy, just this feeling of well-being of, isn't it wonderful to be alive, to be on this planet? You know, it has a blue sky. The sky didn't have to be blue, but it is. And these people, they're my friends. They didn't have to be my friends, but they are. And a curious thing, when I first experienced that emotion, those little outbursts of joy, there's a real puzzle in my own mind of, well, what should I do with these things? Should I hold them at arm's length? Should I embrace them? And then it dawned on me what foolishness that was. I mean, if you experience joy, embrace it. You're a very lucky person if you can have that emotion.
William Irvin, I-R-V-I-N-E is his name. And he is a philosophy professor at Wright State University in Ohio. He's been teaching there for, I believe, 3 decades.
Now, I've got to contribute my personal experience. I've had a very similar set of feelings about the importance of grasping the moment. I had the same experience of walking through a bunch of shops thinking all this stuff that I don't want and I don't need. Thinking, what's a successful day's shopping? Walking through the shops, not buying any of it. And then the next step was to just not go near the shops. It was Ivan Illich who first put me on that vibe. We shall be hearing a little bit more from him at the end of the show. Most of the rest of the show is going to be selected readings from Henry David Thoreau's Walden, but we will be taking a few detours. And now we're going to continue more or less where we left off. This is still the first chapter on economy. Now, I don't know whether Thoreau knew about Stoic philosophy, but he seems to have developed a fairly parallel set of thoughts.
Walden by Henry David Thoreau. Economy, Chapter 1, Part 4. As with our colleges, so with 100 modern improvements. There is an illusion about them. There is not always a positive advance. The devil goes on exacting compound interest to the last for his early share and numerous succeeding investments in them. Our inventions are wont to be pretty toys, which distract our attention from serious things. They are but improved means to an unimproved end, an end which it was already but too easy to arrive at, as railroads lead to Boston or New York. We are in great haste to construct a magnetic telegraph from Maine to Texas. But Maine and Texas, it may be, have nothing important to communicate. Either is in such a predicament as the man who was earnest to be introduced to a distinguished deaf woman. But when he was presented, and one end of her ear trumpet was put into his hand, had nothing to say. As if the main object were to talk fast, and not to talk sensibly. We are eager to tunnel under the Atlantic and bring the old world some weeks nearer to the new. But perchance the first news that will leak through into the broad, flapping American ear will be that the Princess Adelaide has the whooping cough. After all, the man whose horse trots a mile in a minute does not carry the most important messages. He is not an evangelist, nor does he come round eating locusts and wild honey. I doubt if Flying Childers ever carried a peck of corn to mill. One says to me, "I wonder that you do not lay up money. You love to travel. You might take the cars and go to Fitchburg today and see the country." But I am wiser than that. I have learned that the swiftest traveler is he that goes afoot. I say to my friend, "Suppose we try who will get there first. The distance is 30 miles, the fare 90 cents. That is almost a day's wages. I remember when wages were 60 cents a day for laborers on this very road. Well, I start now on foot, and get there before night. I have traveled at that rate by the week together. You will, in the meanwhile, have earned your fare and arrive there sometime tomorrow, or possibly this evening if you are lucky enough to get a job in season. Instead of going to Fitchburg, you will be working here the greater part of the day. And so, if the railroad reached round the world, I think that I should keep ahead of you. And as for seeing the country and getting experience of that kind, I should have to cut your acquaintance altogether." Such is the universal law which no man can ever outwit, and with regard to the railroad, even we may say it is as broad as it is long. To make a railroad round the world available to all mankind is equivalent to grading the whole surface of the planet. Men have an indistinct notion that if they keep up this activity of joint stocks and spades long enough, all will at length ride somewhere, in next to no time and for nothing. But though a crowd rushes to the depot, and the conductor shouts, "All aboard!" when the smoke is blown away and the vapor condensed, it will be perceived that a few are riding, but the rest are run over, and it will be called, and will be, a melancholy accident. No doubt they can ride at last who shall have earned their fare, that is, if they survive so long, but they will probably have lost their elasticity and desire to travel by that time. This spending of the best part of one's life earning money in order to enjoy a questionable liberty during the least valuable part of it reminds me of the Englishman who went to India to make a fortune first, in order that he might return to England and live the life of a poet. He should have gone up garret at once. "What?" exclaim a million Irishmen, starting up from all the shanties in the land. "Is not this railroad which we have built a good thing?" "Yes," I answer, "comparatively good. That is, you might have done worse. But I wish, as you are brothers of mine, that you could have spent your time better than digging in this dirt." Before I finish my house, wishing to earn $10 or $12 by some honest and agreeable method, in order to meet my unusual expenses, I planted about 2.5 acres of light and sandy soil near it, chiefly with beans, but also a small part with potatoes, corn, peas, and turnips. The whole lot contains 11 acres, mostly growing up to pines and hickories, and was sold the preceding season for $8.08 an acre. One farmer said that it was, quote, good for nothing but to raise cheeping squirrels on, end quote. I put no manure whatever on this land, not being the owner but merely a squatter, and not expecting to cultivate so much again, and I did not quite hoe it all at once. I got out several cords of stumps and plowing, which supplied me with fuel for a long time, and left small circles of virgin mold, easily distinguishable, through the summer by the greater luxuriance of the beans there. The dead, and for the most part unmerchantable wood behind my house, and the driftwood from the pond, have supplied the remainder of my fuel. I was obliged to hire a team and a man for the plowing, though I held the plow myself. My farm outgoes for the first season were, for implements, seed, work, etc., $14.72 plus. The seed corn was given me. This never costs anything to speak of, unless you plant more than enough. I got 12 bushels of beans and 18 bushels of potatoes, besides some peas and sweet corn. The yellow corn and turnips were too late to come to anything. The whole income from the farm was $23.44. Deducting the outgoes, $14.72 plus, there are left $8.71 plus. Beside produce consumed and on hand at the time, this estimate was made of the value of $4.50, the amount on hand much more than balancing a little grass which I did not raise. All things considered, that is, considering the importance of a man's soul and of today, notwithstanding the short time occupied by my experiment, nay, partly even because of its transient character, I believe that was doing better than any farmer in Concord did that year. The next year I did better still, for I spaded up all the land which I required, about a third of an acre, and I learned from the experience of both years, not being in the least awed by many celebrated works on husbandry, Arthur Young among the rest, that if one would live simply and eat only the crop which he raised, and raise no more than he ate, and not exchange it for an insufficient quantity of more luxurious and expensive things, he would need to cultivate only a few rods of ground, and that it would be cheaper to spade up that than to use oxen to plow it, and to select a fresh spot from time to time than to manure the old, and he could do all his necessary farm work, as it were, with his left hand at odd hours in the summer. And thus he would not be tied to an ox, or horse, or cow, or pig, as at present. I desire to speak impartially on this point, and as one not interested in the success or failure of the present economical and social arrangements. I was more independent than any farmer in Concord, for I was not anchored to a house or farm, but could follow the bent of my genius, which is a very crooked one, every moment.
Now, as a teacher, how much I wish I had children who talked about following the bent of their geniuses. Of course, they're too busy worrying about standardized tests, and their head has been filled with junk that old men wanted it filled with. We know everybody needs to have food, so what happens if people feel incompetent to produce it? Then they're going to be a slave to whoever does produce the food. One of my discoveries has been how easy it actually is to grow food if you know what you're doing. And learning is a bit late in life for me, but better late than never. The internet has been a great help, perhaps the Bangladesh soil, but nature really does seem to actually do so much, even without any of the modern technologies. Why doesn't school get round to that? Of course, the powers that be don't want this. The powers that be want predictable and dependable people. That means, if they have any kind of personal philosophy, It has to be something which is mass-produced, something which is subject to external control. So we don't want people who work on their own principles, ideas about doing things because they're the right thing to do, very dangerous. So much safer to have people who can be externally controlled. Remember the episode we had on economic literacy, where if you use a cost-benefit analysis, that's the right answer. Any other type of reasoning is the wrong answer. Well, if you missed it, that episode was episode 506 on how moral dumbing down ensures every man has his price. Well, let's hear the following short section. This is called Principles, a section from chapter 10 of John Taylor Gatto's Underground History of American Education. And I think it's worth bearing in mind when we discuss whether people have a philosophy or the default philosophy. Getting back to Alfie Cohn's point, is it the fact that humans are naturally selfish, greedy? No, human nature is very flexible and can be adapted to any different variety. So why is it so monotone, fixed on selfish maximization? Well, let's hear John Taylor Gatto reading.
5 days a week, the school turned its children out in the morning to march up the hill to Waverley or down to the end of the town to high school. There was no school bus. Waverley was frozen midway between the one-room schoolhouse tradition of transferring responsibility to the children. We fought to fill the inkwells, clean the pen nibs, sweep the floor, serve in the lunchroom, clean the erasers, help our slower classmates in arithmetic and reading, and the specialized procedures and curriculum of the slowly dawning corporate age of schooling. While this latter style had been sold as more socially efficient, ever since 1905, the realities of town life were such that nothing passed muster at Waverley which didn't first pass muster with parents and the elders of the town. School was something you took like medicine. You did it because your mother had done it and your grandmother. It was supposed to be good for you. Nobody believed it was decisively so. Looking back, I might agree this daily exercise with neighbours suddenly transformed into grammarians, historians, and mathematicians might well have been, as mother said, good for me. One thing is certain, these part-time specialists cared a great deal about mother's opinion of what they were doing, just as she cared about theirs in regard to her parenting. The school teachers I remember are few but bear noting. Peg Hill, who spoke to me exactly the way she did to the principal, and won my heart for treating me as a peer. Miss Wibble, who taught me to sing and memorize song lyrics so ferociously that my vocabulary and dramatic repertoire increased geometrically, even if we did whisper to each other that she was reading love books at her desk as we copied the day's words. Old Miss McCulloch, who played American Patrol every single day for an entire school year on her hand-cranked phonograph, "You must be vigilant, you must be diligent, American Patrol." Her expressionless face and brutally stark manner stifled any inclination to satire. If we have to have school teachers, let some of them be this kind of teacher. At Waverley, I learned about principle when Miss Hill read from Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. She read of the courageous death of Blandina the Slave, a teenage convert to Christianity, who was offered her life to repudiate her faith, and a cruel death if she refused. She refused. I learnt that all the management savvy of the most powerful empire in history couldn't overwhelm the principles of a teenage slave. Principles were a daily part of every study at Waverley. In latter days, schools replaced principles with an advanced form of pragmatism called situational ethics, whose principles were shown to be variable according to the demands of the moment. During the 1970s, forcing this study on children became an important part of a school religion. People with flexible principles reserve the right to betray their covenants. It's that simple. The misery of modern life can be graphed in the rising incidence of people who exercise the right to betray each other, whether business associates, friends, or even family. Pragmatists like to keep their options open. When you live by principles, whatever semantic ambiguity they involve you in, there are clear boundaries to what you will allow, even when nobody is watching.
Now, to some of this pre-programming in the direction of economic self-maximization, as measured, of course, by that universal privately controlled monopoly, money, to some of that focus on money explained the antipathy which people feel, the hostility towards a man such as Suelo, who's taken a moral stance against using money. Let's hear another question from his FAQ.
Question 28. You're a hypocrite, a bum, mentally ill, an egotist, self-righteous, saying you live moneyless. But you can live this way only because you're in a land of wealth and industrious people. Aren't you biting the hand that feeds you? Why do you scavenge off civilization's waste rather than live off the land or grow your own food? Can I compare myself to wild animals? Okay, I'm somewhat like wild animals, but not completely. I have lived solely off the wild land 4 different times in my life, and I work on an organic farm. I still supplement my diet with wild edibles and farm food. But I'm also a scavenger of civilization, like a raven, sort of. Here's why. Somebody wrote to me, "But swallows and pigeons could live without all of this, and they would survive. They just chose an easier way to get food and shelter, but naturally they would survive without it. Would you survive without remainders from the supermarkets? Would you survive without your clothes and shoes? Would you be happy without the internet and so on? These animals would survive, or not survive, without these products of civilization just as much as we would. But they would not survive without each other. I cannot survive without the industriousness of my fellow human, whether it's fire, arrowheads, or clothes. I cannot survive without human assistance, just as a wolf cannot survive without the pack, or the lion without the pride. I dare say industriousness and technology would exist with or without money. If you took away a swallow or a pigeon's family attic or building, I guarantee the family would most likely die, or at least struggle harshly, just as we would, just as an owl family would if you took away its natural hollow tree. Take away a sunken ship, a product of civilization, and you destroy a whole coral ecosystem. Nature makes no distinction between what's natural and what's not natural. Nature integrates everything. First, I can take or leave the internet, but it is my instinctual urge to speak my path to the world. If there were no internet, I'd probably be on an old-fashioned soapbox. I'm glad, though, that I can take advantage of the internet. If the collapse of money means the collapse of the internet, I'm okay with that. But I believe the internet and all technology can survive and actually come into balance when money ceases. Despite appearances, I am not a primitivist, nor am I against technology. The point of my living this way is to be able to go anywhere and do anything, relying on faith to lead me, acknowledging my total dependence upon my human neighbour, and my human neighbour's total dependence upon me. I am dependent upon my neighbour, and my neighbour is dependent upon me, not the illusion of money, despite appearances. Living solely off the land, or growing one's own food, quietly living apart from conventional civilization, is a good path, and I have friends who do it. If so-called self-sufficiency is what impresses folks, I have lived off the land at 4 different times of my life, eating only wild edibles, twice in Alaska, once in a long trek down the North California coast, once in the Gila wilderness. I've made many of my own clothes, even now having a winter wool jacket I made. I've learned how to make fiber cords from plants, animal fur, and to knit and sew. I'm sure I can make my own shoes and forego my glasses. However, such things are not so important to me anymore. I've realized I have another path, another duty. I usually live in a cave or other camp simply because there's no other way I can ethically follow my path without supporting a corrupt system. But I'm not here to prove my self-sufficiency, not here to be isolated from civilization, but to mingle and to challenge and cultivate the moneyless, freely give, freely receive instinct that already exists within everybody, within civilization. It's worth being called a hypocrite and a bum and a mentally ill and egotist and self-righteous if it brings you to read this right now. You're at this very moment thinking outside the conventional box of civilization, are you not? It's so worth it to me that you are right now thinking outside the box, even if it means you believe me a hypocrite for using this computer, for scavenging civilization's waste, for putting myself on a soapbox and saying, look at me, look at me! Even if it means you think I'm a self-righteous egotist for looking down on you, it's worth it, because you're now thinking outside the box. It's so worth it, I'm giggling in my deepest bones. Why hide the light under a basket? We humans have been given mouths to speak, and every time any human opens his or her mouth to speak, isn't he or she saying, look at me! Don't you speak when you need to speak? Maybe one day my ego will run away with me. I'm not immune to becoming a ridiculous egotist. Pray that it not be. But know that now you're getting challenged to the truth, regardless of what you think of me. Let me be a fool if it means conventional thinking is challenged. And if you profess yourself to be a Christian, are you not most likely right now having to face the teachings of the Jesus you previously ignored, even now getting challenged to look at the Jesus you claim to believe? It matters not what you think of me. What a bogus nutcase I might be, then, does it? Let us all be fools if it means bringing down injustice in the world. It is my duty to scavenge. I feel it's our responsibility to not waste things, to use everything, not to throw perfectly good things into landfills, especially in a world where millions are starving. And I cannot, in good conscience, kill a deer or a fish if I don't need to, while there are literally hundreds of fresh dead animals thrown into dumpsters every day. If I had money, I couldn't buy most meat supporting an industry that has such disregard for living things. But I will surely retrieve them. The dignity of their lives must be restored. In a world where millions upon millions are starving, our waste is obscene and immoral. Yes, I dare use that forbidden word. I can assure you that, in the USA alone, I see with my own eyes there is enough perfectly good food thrown away to feed the entire world. Most of it is inaccessible, locked away in dumpsters, for your safety, a common, incessant quote by corporate managers and law enforcement officers. The generosity of a society is inversely proportional to its waste. I would be overjoyed if I found zero good food thrown away, and I would be forced to find other moneyless methods to live. In a less wasteful society, you can't find good food in dumpsters, but you do find more generous people and way more gratitude. I've travelled abroad and witnessed this myself. This is why I believe one can live the wandering mendicant's life almost anywhere in the world. Faith works everywhere. I often have my doubts about places like the Sudan, but maybe that's because my faith is still weak. But all I know now is where I'm living now, and this is where my duty is. I'll let the Buddhist bhikkhus and Hindu sadhus live moneyless in Asia, and Christian monks live moneyless in Ethiopia, in lands where there's little waste but greater generosity. And I'll live moneyless here, where there's obscene waste and less generosity, and more fear that somebody might be getting something for free. This is what astounds me. Why are there few or no protests about our overwhelming greed and waste? Yet every day people spew venomous anger at a little freegan folks like me for being a leech on society, because we take only what we need and grab a few crumbs that fall from the rich man's table. It's astounding. I ask for nothing, not even food, except occasionally I ask restaurants for food already destined for the dumpster. Oh yeah,